This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're live in New Haven for The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. As always, there's a lot going on in the Elm City, and here to help us sort through it all is an all-star panel today. We'll welcome in our guest, Paul Bass, is editor of the New Haven Independent. Always good to see you, Paul. Thanks for coming in.
John.
Continuing what I think we're calling Mark Oppenheimer Week on WNPR. Mark Oppenheimer is here. He's a religion columnist for the New York Times and author of several books, including the ebook Zen Predator of the Upper East Side. Hi, Mark.
Hi, and a New Haven resident.
And a New Haven resident, absolutely.
That's all that qualifies me to be here in Paul and James's presence.
Now, James Walker is here. He's metro editor of the New Haven Register, relatively new to the job. And welcome into the wheelhouse, James.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
And you're relatively new to the New Haven area. So
I am.
This is great. You're going to get into the wheelhouse with us. And Colin McEnroe is not here in New Haven. He joins us from Hartford. I was joking in the introduction, Colin. That means you don't get any pizza today.
Well, I overheard Oppie trying to sell a condo to Mr. Walker.
So. Yeah. doing real estate deals right
he's
here.
He's the Century 21 now, in addition to his journalism.
Exactly. He doesn't have enough going on. If you want to join us, as always, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. And I'll put a special call out to residents of New Haven and the New Haven area. What are the big issues that are affecting your life in New Haven right now? We're going to be talking about how they might affect not only the city and the surrounding towns, but also the upcoming governor's race here. Again, 860-275-7266. We'd love to hear from you from all over the state and the region, but especially from New Haven today. Now, Paul, you were following the governor around, and he was kind of making, I guess, an election stop, but he's not officially running, as we keep saying, on the air yet. But he was in New Haven. What was he talking about? Who was he talking to?
Yesterday, he's been in New Haven a lot. Just as when Chris Murphy ran for Senate, when people want to win statewide and the Democrats, they basically become New Haven residents for those 2 years because we have the largest Democratic Party. It votes in the largest numbers for the candidate. So Dan Malloy knows he would not be governor today without having gotten an 18,000 vote margin in New Haven 4 years ago, which was three times his whole statewide margin of victory. Yesterday, he focused on what were called urban issues, which becomes code work for African-American. And so he went to the 94.3 stop with Juan Castillo, the DJ, and talked about why he thinks there's a lot of racism against President Obama and why he's pushing for the minimum wage. He went to the Dixwell Q House, which has a great symbolism in New Haven. It was a community center for about 90 years. And then it, through fiscal mismanagement and other reasons, it fell apart. And it became a symbol for people in New Haven, especially in Black New Haven, for the disappearance of community centers. And that became a symbol for not enough for young people to do. So Malloy came with a gift, $1 million planning grant for to try to build a new Q House, which they're trying to do in New Haven. And that was what he was up to yesterday.
Let's actually listen to a little bit of his appearance on WYBC. He was responding to questions about state pilot money. And I know we always love to talk about pilot money, payment in
lieu of taxes.
Actually,
that was in an interview with me.
This is afterward? Okay, let's listen a little bit to the governor.
If you put pilot increases, particularly those that we're pushing this year, along with the school dollars that we're sending, we're actually sending millions and millions of dollars more per year to New Haven than we were before I was elected governor. So there are more than one pot of money. And so if you look particularly at the education side, New Haven has done extremely well. Now, having said that, for a long time, I think pilot was underfunded, and that's why in this year's budget we are increasing pilots. We'll in fact, you know, pretty substantially at about 2%. And out of that allotment, New Haven will get, I think, $2.5 million on top of additional dollars on the education cost sharing side as well.
And again, that's Governor Daniel Malloy responding to a question from Paul Bass. Colin, I hear you laughing in the background.
Well, I mean, obviously, you know, we've been through most of the Malloy administration, grappling with bleak economic realities, which he'd be happy to tell you that he inherited from somebody else, and everything's hardship. And, you know, we're really at the moment, as we head towards the election, very comparable to the moment in Wizard of Oz when they go from black and white to technicolor. So whatever's really coming out of his mouth, he's basically saying, we represent the Lollipop League. You know, he's just got lollipops for everybody. So it's good times.
But his point there was that lollipops come in many flavors.
Right.
So in New Haven, they're upset. For listeners who don't know what pilot is, that means payments.
Let's explain what pilot is.
Yeah. That's payments in lieu of taxes. Yeah. So cities like New Haven, half the property you can't tax because they're hospitals and universities. So we can't collect as much, everyone pays higher taxes. So the city had a, the state had a law called pilot, which they're allowed to give up to 77% of that money back that you lose. And they keep whittling away at it. It's down to 32% for most of that property. So New Haven says, we want that money. Dan Malloy says, we can't just give out endless lollipops. So we're putting all that money into schools. So he said, we changed the formula so schools get more money. New Haven, they said, structurally, we need that money because now we might raise taxes again and drive more people out of the city. So that's what that argument's about.
I'm wondering if before, because we could certainly talk about pilot all day long here on shows like Where We Live, but I want to get to Mark Oppenheimer and talk a little bit about some of the things that are really important to New Haven voters today. If Governor Malloy came by your neighborhood and started asking, you know, what are the things that people in New Haven are caring about right now?
Well, you know, I like Paul, we live in a middle-class neighborhood where most people have jobs. So I think, you know, it'd be a different question if you went to neighborhoods where there's tremendous unemployment. I mean, I think, you know, in my neighborhood, some of the issues are really city management issues. And, you know, it's for example, it's magnet lottery time for the schools. Still a process that doesn't have sufficient transparency, that's not user-friendly, still a process where you think that if you, you know, found a really good computer science graduate of, you know, 23 years old and paid him a little money, he or she could come up with a better web-based system with more clarity, more transparency, more fairness for registering your kids for schools, figuring out where they're going to go, having some sense of security heading into the next year than the hodgepodge that we have now. And they don't seem to be able to get that right. So honestly, I know more people from my middle-class neighborhood who think of moving to the suburbs for reasons of just frustration with bureaucracy and schools than for economic reasons. But again, I mean, that's a luxury. It's a privileged neighborhood where people have jobs.
Talk about what you're hearing from people who maybe don't have jobs from some of the less privileged neighborhoods in New Haven, Paul.
Well, there are two New Havens, as we know.
Yeah.
So in Westville and East Rock, it's, first of all, people are going to be very mad maybe about the snow next year still. They're mad the snow didn't get plowed and they take that out on the governor. But yeah, in crime, even though we've cut down the number of murders and shootings, there were still 67 last year shootings and 20 murders. There's still, the governor knows, and the way he was talking yesterday, that jobs and crime are big issues in lower income neighborhoods. And then public safety is still somewhat, but as Mark says, schools and taxes seem to be the big issue in the middle class neighborhoods.
I know, James, one of the things that we were talking about before the show is, and that the governor mentions when he makes a swing through New Haven, is he talks about the minimum wage. He had the president of the United States come in and back him. He's going to be talking to urban voters, not just in New Haven, but around the state about this. Obviously, this is an issue that the governor has to spend a lot of time on to get votes in the cities.
And I think it's very important for a lot of minorities. Excuse me, a lot of minorities are in low paying jobs. So earning $10.10 an hour is critical for them. So I think Malloy is making all the right moves in order to court the minority vote. $10.10 an hour is critical. And let's face it, $10.10 an hour is still not a lot of money to live on in the state of Connecticut.
Good, Colin, I'd love to get your thoughts a little bit on as we talk about the governor before we move on to some more New Haven specific things. I know that Tom Foley, probably his clearly his leading challenger on the Republican side, has made some efforts to try to talk more about cities and more about urban issues. Do you think that the governor has a good urban strategy for his reelection campaign?
You know, I think that remains to be seen. And I do think that Foley, in a way that's kind of unusual for a Republican, is trying to hijack a little bit of an urban strategy. I know that he's actually been down to some of the new police chief in New Haven has these kind of public meetings, which anybody can go to. Foley's been going to some of those, I think. I actually rather use the time of my answer. I have a question for Oppie and for Paul, and that is, to what degree have the wounds of the primary and the election healed? In other words, to what degree can Dan Malloy come to New Haven and speak to a fairly unified Democratic body? Obviously, he endorsed Harpin at a time that was sort of, you know, it was a choice, and it was a potentially divisive choice, and Elliker people may not like that too much. I don't know. How together are people now?
Well, I think what Colin's referring to, John, is that New Haven had a very divided electorate. We had our first real mayor election in 20 years, and we found a very divided city by race and by class, but also by mindset. People who were newer to the city and were less devoted to parties and old party structures, and people who were more out of a civil rights tradition. Can he heal that? I still think the wounds are there, not about personality. It's not people are mad that Mayor Harp won and Justin Ehrlich are lost. Those were the two candidates. That's already history. I do think he has to deal with this taxes issue that they're concerned about. And I think that's, I think that he can overcome that. What I'm wondering why Malloy doesn't get flack about in New Haven and other cities is mass transit. Mm-hmm. I mean, that has been destroyed. The buses system has just gotten, because I take buses a lot. They're terrible in New Haven. They don't come off and it shuts down after 6 or 7 at night as though people don't even hang out in the dark. And I don't know why he's gotten away with, and the Ehrlicher people in the vote you're talking about, the newer kind of new urbanist coalition, mm-hmm. they very much care about mass transit and walkable streets. And he's been a car governor.
Yeah. Yeah. Mark?
Well, and it's a largely suburban and ex-urban state. But I was just out in, you know, I'm glad you asked that question, Colin, because Paul's right that it really it wasn't just about the personalities, and I actually think that people have been very classy and gentlemen and gentlewomanly about healing those wounds from the primary and coming together. And but it wasn't just about the personalities; it was about this sort of different sense of vision. If you heard what someone like Ehrlicher and some of the people who supported him were talking about, I was reminded of those conversations when I was out in Seattle last week. You know, and here's this place that's so advanced in terms of bike lanes, so advanced in terms of mass transit, and it makes everyone feel so good about the city. And you know, they have a director of the, they have like a neighborhoods department there. They have a cabinet level person in the mayor's office who's in charge of just saying how can our neighborhoods be happier and work better. And they're always thinking about livability in ways that aren't necessarily super expensive, but that you know, take a different look at what a city can be. And when I would talk with some of the Harp supporters about that, they were totally unmoved by that. I mean, they just didn't get it. They didn't care. It sounded like yuppie issues to them, but it's not. I mean, something like mass transit is a real, because who takes mass transit? I mean, everybody.
And of course, the first thing Harp did when she became mayor was say that mass transit is a civil rights issue. We want bike lanes. Like any, right. Like Ben DeLito, who was mayor, the first thing he did was court that vote through the arts. You go to the people who voted against you, find out what they care about most, and make that a centerpiece of your agenda. Well,
and we've had this issue a lot in Hartford. When we talk about walkability, it seems like one of these yuppie issues about new urbanism. But who walks in the city? Who takes the bus? It's you know, largely people who need to take the bus and really need public transportation. I know, James, you cover a lot of the suburbs around here, and you hail from Fairfield County. How does this conversation about mass transportation in New Haven strike you?
Well, I can assure you my coworkers know that mass transportation in Connecticut is a major problem, particularly here in New Haven. You just cannot get around in a reasonable amount of time. I will arrive at Union Station on the hour, and it will take me an additional hour to get to the New Haven Register, which
is absurd.
Wait a
second, you're talking like half a mile.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. You have to get off at Union Station. You'll have to wait for a bus to take you to the Green. Then at the Green, you have to wait for a bus.
That's
to
the
transfer.
Opposite direction.
That's correct. You can walk. I can walk.
You're walking that big bridge they built.
I can walk, and it takes me 20 minutes. But I'm an old guy.
Well, and it's also, and it's not the most pleasant walk.
No,
that's the thing. It's not like it's right there, and it's just a half mile of just walking. No. Lovely through a park. It's actually a difficult walk.
Yeah, it's a very difficult walk. It's up, down.
Do they even have sidewalks on that bridge?
Yes, they do. They do have sidewalks. But transportation is a major problem, particularly with Metro North undergoing a lot of problems, period. And New Haven, really, it's absurd. They shut down at 11:30 at night.
Well, also the buses pretty much stop running with any regularity after 6.
Yes.
But I think it's really important to bring that up, though. In New Haven, we can use this as a little petri dish for the way the rest of the state runs. But, Paul, we talk a lot about commuter issues when it comes to Metro North or how the highways are. How do people get in and out of, you know, their jobs in Hartford or their jobs in New York City? But the on-the-ground transportation issues, frankly, the state just doesn't pay as much attention to, it seems.
Yeah, they build for the car.
Yeah, they build for the car.
It's
all the
not
time.
The Department of Transportation. It's the Department of Cars, and get out of the way.
Yeah, well, maybe when we come back from our break, we'll talk about some more things that are happening in New Haven. Of course, if you haven't been down here for a while, you are seeing some construction on the place that was really built for the car, that Route 34 connector. There's a lot of building going on in town. We're going to talk about what the new mayor of New Haven means and some new shuffles there. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. We're in New Haven today. We're talking with Paul Bass from the New Haven Independent, Mark Oppenheimer, who is a writer for the New York Times and author of several books, James Walker, who's Metro Editor for the New Haven Register, and, of course, our own Colin McEnroe. It's The Wheelhouse and Where We Live. This is where we live. I'm John Dankowski, and it's The Wheelhouse. It's a Wednesday, so it's our weekly news roundtable. But today, we decided to come down to New Haven, to our New Haven studios, and talk with some New Haven panelists today, people giving us a little sense of what's happening in the Elm City. Paul Bass, editor of the New Haven Independent. Mark Oppenheimer, who's a regular contributor to WNPR and a religion columnist for the New York Times and a New Haven resident. And James Walker's here. He's metro editor of the New Haven Register. Joining us from our Hartford studios is Colin McEnroe, host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. What's coming up this afternoon at 1? Colin.
Well, John, I know you're a big fan of Martin Hayes. In my mind, he is the Irish fiddler who's the most creative, the most innovative, the guy who's overlaying about 9 other musical traditions on the traditional Irish fiddle. He's going to be in studio with us along with Steve Dietrich, who's the primary promoter of Celtic music, I think, around Connecticut. So we're about 2 days late for St. Patrick's Day, but we wanted to wait until Martin got here.
Well, yeah, it's a week-long celebration, and you won't want to miss Martin Hayes playing live in the studio. He's actually got a concert, one of 2 concerts he has coming up at the University of Hartford. One this Saturday, and I will definitely be there because I love to hear Martin when I can. We're going to get back into some issues that are happening here in New Haven. I want to go to the phones, 860-275-7266, and especially get to some people from the New Haven area to talk about some of the big issues that they care about. Let's go to Ann, who's calling from New Haven. Hi there, Ann. You're on Where We Live.
Hello. How are you?
Doing well. What's up?
I'm calling about 2 issues that really concern me. The first is the utilities plan to clear-cut 8 feet around all the phone, the utility poles in the state, actually, and their program it's called an enhanced tree trimming program, and it's really tree devastation, and so I'm really concerned about that, and have joined many of my neighbors and other citizens of Connecticut who have spoken up about this, but the utilities, CLMP and UI, are just flaunting their power and just refuse to acknowledge the fact that this is a poorly designed plan that isn't going to actually ensure reliable service. And so there's that issue. And the other issue is I'm in favor of supporting the current legislation that's being proposed by Senator Looney to provide pilot funds, payment in lieu of tax funds, to support the cities, especially New Haven, since so much of our land is off the tax rolls because of the large number of nonprofits that we have in town.
Well, Ann, thanks very much for those 2 things. And we talked about pilot a little bit earlier, Paul, but I want to get back to the trees. But before we move on to that, she mentions you know, Martin Looney taking a lead on this issue. We were just talking earlier this week to the Speaker of the House, Brendan Sharkey. He's got a whole new pilot plan, and this is a different sort of pilot plan. This isn't one where, you know, the towns are going looking for money. This is one where the individual organizations would be paying the full boat on taxes and then negotiating with the state and the towns for money. How does this strike you?
That's very interesting on 2 scores. So Martin Looney has a bill that says we're going to set up tiers of cities in need based on how much non-taxable property they have and guarantee that you get at least 50% of your money back if you're New Haven. So people consider that somewhat of a good Band-Aid. Sharkey, the House Majority Leader, he comes from Hamden. He says universities and hospitals aren't what they used to be. Mm-hmm. They're big, profitable engines, and they should pay taxes. And that's a revolutionary concept in Connecticut. It's not going to happen this year, but a lot of people look at that, both at the federal and state levels, and say yes. And it's going to take a while to get there. And what's interesting about it is that Sharkey comes from Hamden and not New Haven. And for a long time, there's been this divide in Connecticut between central cities and the rest of the states that made their towns to exist just to not be central cities and take advantage of their tax advantages. Inner ring suburbs like Hamden now have the same problems. Hamden has Quinnipiac University, West Haven has UNH. And they are now going to be a coalition, and this issue will get legs.
I think this is, by the way, my hat is off to Sharkey about this. I've often found him kind of an annoying speaker. But I think this is the most revolutionary and interesting proposal maybe in the legislature this year. And really, he's right. I mean, look, your CEO makes $500,000 or $1 million, and you're a not-for-profit, tax-exempt. Come on.
Well, it's not. And you know, maybe, Colin, you join me in saying it's not just big universities and hospitals. I mean, you and I are alumni of fancy high schools that have millions and millions of dollars and aren't paying taxes to the towns that they're in. I mean, in New Haven, you have Hopkins, which has, you know, tens, if not over $100 million in its endowment. You know, Loomis Chafee, where I went, Kingswood, Oxford, Hotchkiss. I mean, this is a state with probably more, you know, $100 million plus endowed high schools per capita anyway than any other. Massachusetts might have more. And these places are off the tax rolls. In some of these towns, I mean, what could Wallingford do if Choate had to pay a little property tax?
But one of the things, and James, this comes up in Hamden, for instance. So Paul mentioned Quinnipiac University. I was just remarking to somebody yesterday, I hadn't been on the Quinnipiac campus for some time, and just it's how it's grown, how the campus has grown, how they've taken over. It's almost like Yale and Hamden. They own all the property. Well, what Quinnipiac says is, but look, we're generating economic activity here. There are restaurants that didn't used to be. There are jobs that didn't used to be there. Should we really have to pay all the taxes because we're helping to develop a place that was basically just a drive-through?
I'm not sure that matters. They're still a business. They're still making a profit, and they should pay taxes.
I mean, they're not making a profit in the sense that they're not shareholders who take dividends, right? There's nobody, right. You know, nobody makes more than their salary. There's no there's no dividend structure. You can't buy shares in it.
That is true, but you're still taxing. What you're doing though is you're still utilizing police. You're still utilizing services that taxpayers are paying
and also
for.
And also, for-profit corporations sometimes don't make a profit, and non-for-profit corporations do have surpluses. They should be fired. Any academic who makes that argument, John, should be kicked out of academia because it's such a stupid argument.
Which argument,
the
Paul?
Corporate welfare argument. We generate spin-off revenue, right. So therefore don't tax us. Right. That's what for-profit businesses say. That's how they hold states hostage to give them corporate welfare, by saying you have to make us avoid paying taxes so that we can generate jobs and income. That is an intellectually dishonest and stupid argument.
I love Paul Bass.
I love you, Colin.
But, I mean, does this – so we all think that this is at least an interesting idea. Colin, does it go anywhere, do you think?
I don't think it goes anywhere this session. But, you know, this is the way that these things work. It's sort of a, you know, a battering ram, and eventually the doors cave in about 3, 4, or 5 sessions down the line. But, you know, Sharkey gets props, I think, for being the guy to talk about this. He really has kind of untapped.
Is it legal? This isn't a federal thing that these places are tax exempt?
There are state exemptions and federal exemptions. So it's so interesting, and I still get confused about it every 5 years when it comes up, is Yale University has these separate exemptions. There was an 18-something law that gave 6 specific universities a separate exemption based on what percentage of their building produces for-profit revenue. So it's a very complicated matter that can be amended.
One of the things I'll just say that I'm a bit confused by in his proposal is essentially what the speaker is saying is that a university would be charged the full tax rate, and then they would go and negotiate with the local town to see if they can get it down from the full tax rate. What that does in a state in which we already have 169 municipalities and police forces and everything else all divvied up into these tiny little postage stamp communities is that now every single town is going to negotiate with their nonprofits under this plan in order to get the best possible deal. So I could see how we'd have even more of these universities or hospitals holding up a community for a better deal.
And guess who's going to have the better lawyers, the better lobbyists, and the better ability to fund people to run. But the other thing that could happen here is by opening this issue, Sharkey might push the nonprofits to use their might to lobby the state for full pilot funding. So it's in Yale, New Haven's interest, and Yale's interest to fix it the way pilot works at the state so they don't get taxed.
We're talking about the news of the week in the Wheelhouse here on Where We Live, and we're taking some calls, especially from people in New Haven at 860-275-7266, as we're here in our New Haven.
We're
going
to talk about trees, by the way.
Yeah. Oh, we have to talk about trees. Hold on. Yes. Let me take this phone call quickly. We have to talk about – everyone wants to talk about trees, but first, Matthew in New Haven.
I don't want to talk about trees.
Okay, Mark doesn't want to talk about trees.
I talked about trees last week.
Matthew, what do you want to talk about?
Colin.
Hi, Matthew.
Hey, guys.
Hi. What's up?
Oh, hi. This is Matthew Nemerson. You know me.
Oh, hi. I didn't know it was you, Matt. Good to hear from you.
Yeah, so I just thought you were talking about New Haven, and so I thought I'd just call in and be part of the conversation.
Well, we've talked about a lot so far. Yeah, what do you want to talk about? What's your big issue, Matt?
Well, you know, as development administrator for the city, we're certainly interested in all the topics you've been talking about. It was interesting to hear about the transportation issue. That's been something that you know, the mayor is very keen on that. She's talked about transportation as a civil rights issue. And, you know, we're definitely looking at how people get from the neighborhoods to jobs around the city. And we're definitely trying to talk about how to connect the train station and everything else to the downtown more effectively. There's, as you guys were talking about, Route 34. We've got a lot of highway work going on. But also, the whole idea of how do we really think about a modern bus system? How do we think about light rail? How do we think about all of the different ways that a city can grow and be more competitive? You know, and a lot of the people that we're talking to, and I think you've mentioned this on the air already, young people aren't thinking about cars. You know, you've got Zipcar, but a lot of people that we talk to who are moving into software companies or biotech companies in the city, they're comparing New Haven to Boston or New York or other cities where you don't really need a car. So that's going to be part of our competitiveness, is how we can actually make that transportation work for people who are looking at an urban life and not just comparing us to a suburban one.
But, Paul, you want to jump in on anything that Matt has to say? I don't know if you have any questions. You probably get to talk to Matt all the time.
We do get to talk to Matt all the time. I'll tell you, it's interesting. Matt Nemerson is part of the new team at City Hall. He's been around New Haven. He helped build Science Park at the beginning of the early 80s. He's now in charge of economic development. What's been interesting to watch Matthew and some of the new people in City Hall is they are trying very hard to listen to people. They're really, you know, it's a 20-year reset. Two Sundays ago, I saw them on a Sunday when they've been working hard all week, and they had the 11th public meeting about how to rebuild one big block of the Route 34 connector. That's the highway that was, mini highway that was created that never got built, where they destroyed a neighborhood in the 60s. And now under new urbanism, we're trying to build that up at the neighborhoods. And there was a core of people, so a lot of people liked the idea of what to build there. Matthew and his team had inherited an idea that they were trying to make a little better. And there were a bunch of people who thought it was a really terrible idea. And in addition to bad, you know, raising their objections, they would say to the city, this hasn't been public. So the city would have another meeting. This hasn't been public. So they'd have another meeting, and the same people come up, and they'd make their arguments. And for 3 hours on that Sunday, the mayor, Matthew, the developer, who's a pretty big shot developer, the city officials, they sat there and they listened to every objection again. And they talked about it in full again about why they were doing what they were doing. They talked about some changes they might make, some changes they wouldn't. And, you know, process is not a substitute for product. But a good process does improve a product. And I have to say that I've been very impressed with the energy and the openness they've brought into the city. Now, it's early. We'll see what Matthew's like when he gets beat up for another 6 months and if he won't be calling into NPR anymore. But, you know.
No, he'll always call into NPR, yeah. Which is one of the reasons
right,
we like
yeah.
that. Just very quickly, before we move on to trees, to answer the other question there, are there other changes, James, that you're seeing with this new mayor in town? I mean, Paul's saying just, you know, openness, talking. Things are different after 20 years. What do you see?
I do think she's reaching out. She's been to an editorial board meeting at the New Haven Register, and she seems to want to be more open. She seems to want to be more connected to the people. And I think so far she's making the right moves. But again, it's early in her administration. We'll see what happens a year from now and where she's at.
Matt, are you still there?
No, I think Matt's gone. But
okay, so I want to know when we're going to get a new parks chief. Because when you look at cities that are really making it, if you look at like a Portland, Oregon, or a Boston, or a Seattle, there is no way they'd be this far into the administration without having a really serious parks person running parks. And we have an acting parks chief, nice person. We have great parks in the city. No major complaints. But is it anywhere on the agenda to get it? I mean, when I was coming out of college, people wanted to move to New York to work for parks. Like getting a job at parks in New York was like, you know, getting a Rhodes Scholarship. It's like it was the coolest place to work.
Mark, rather than a chief, we need a parks budget. They've cut that. We have like a third of the parks workers we used to have, because if you want to raise taxes $150, people are ready to burn down City Hall. I don't know. But, you know, the hard issue is that she visited a jail. And you don't hear about that. She's not going to be mayor a long time. She's not. Yeah. Her press people don't try to build up. She's doing. She sat in the jail with nobody knowing it a week ago in Whaley Avenue and said, "You're all coming out, and here's how we want to make it work." And it's been interesting watching her try to learn some of the lessons her predecessors learned about how to clear the streets, which they screwed up once, how to make certain political hires that she screwed up once. And I think they are having a pretty quick learning curve.
We got to ask about trees, because our caller asked about trees before. She mentioned the idea of the state doing enhanced tree trimming, which I think some of the folks sort of consider like enhanced interrogation versus torture.
It's they're waterboarding all the trees.
It's waterboarding of trees. How is this playing out here? Well, UI down here cutting down trees, CLMP in other parts of the state, but it's been a big issue down on the shoreline.
Oh, everyone's 100% against it. UI is just willy-nilly cutting down all these trees. We do have a park. The acting park chief is also the tree warden. and they don't ask her what trees need to come down, what don't. They're just willy-nilly because these we're having more storms now with climate change and people lose power. There are two interesting ideas in New Haven that are coming up in response to this, John. The question isn't whether you should do this. Everyone knows that it was they're going to be a larger corporation, that they don't know their local community. But the two ideas are interesting. One is whether we should bury our power lines. Like other communities do, it requires a big upfront infrastructure investment.
An enormous
which and you've got to do it over 20 years. But other cities are doing it.
Yeah.
And the reason we don't do it is in this part of the country now that people just don't do long term. But the other idea that came from the Urban Resources Institute, which is this great initiative, this great tree planting group in town, Yale and community, Chris Ozick, he says do nothing. He says it's not a problem. He says this is a natural process in these storms of winnowing out the small percentage of trees that need to be gone. They come down. He says, I'll lose my power for 8 hours or 2 days. But over time, actually we'll have a better infrastructure if you just leave it alone.
If you just leave it alone, let the power go out.
The free market of nature.
When it's the middle of winter time or it's sweltering out, I don't know, James, if that sounds so good to some people.
I can tell you people are very upset about the plan to cut trees. And if you look in the New Haven Register, for example, on Monday's paper, you can take a look at how a neighborhood looks when you cut down all the trees and how barren it is. And quite frankly, I'm assuming that their utility costs must rise dramatically in the summer without the shade or, you know, anything. So people are very upset. And if you look at take a look at Randall Beach's column and a photo that we ran with that, which is of a street with beautiful trees. And just look at the difference between the two photos, and you can see why people are very, very upset at this tree planting.
Colin,
you as a tone-deaf corporation.
Yeah. Well, Colin, I have to say, we come down to New Haven here, we start talking about bikes, we start talking about trees. This is the conversation, this is the New Haven conversation, isn't it?
Yeah, although we talked about trees last week, too. I mean, it is a shifting tide. I mean, when all the snowstorms were here knocking out power, particularly the famous October snowstorm, people were ready to go out with a Saturday night special and blast away the trees, you know, but what they've unleashed now is the Connecticut Chainsaw Massacre. And now legislative leadership, they're trying to stop it. PURA is trying to stop it, but nobody can stop the utilities.
Nobody can stop them. Let's go to Jody, who's calling from New Haven, and we're taking calls from people in New Haven. As we talk about some of the news of the week, there's a lot we want to cover, but people are bringing up such interesting issues. So Jody, what's on your mind?
Well, thanks very much for taking my call. I'm a recent homeowner within the last year in New Haven, and I live in a smaller blue-collar community in New Haven called Morris Cove. The majority of the neighborhood does not sit on the ocean, but in fact sits the way back between Tweed and the ocean. And the federal government has recently taken away, or there's still some stuff going down in D.C., but the flood subsidies are being taken away. This little middle-class area is home to Lighthouse Point, very nice little neighborhood, but, you know, mostly middle-income, lower middle-income people. The issue being that this flood insurance, my flood insurance, is set to go up unless President Obama signs this, 260 to 300% in 1 year, forcing my flood from 1,800 a year to 7,000.
So, this is sort of the flip side of what we were talking about before with all the power outages and burying power lines.
Yeah.
On the shoreline, we have this issue with flooding. I think a lot of people, Jody, will ask, you know, we're thinking about how we rebuild our shorelines in cute communities like this, really nice historic communities, and also places up and down the seacoast. And how much should the government, whether it's the federal government or anybody else, be underwriting people rebuilding in places that flood all the time?
Jody, why did you buy there, Jody?
Well, I am not on the ocean, and my home is a little $175,000 home that has never, ever, ever been flooded. It's not what we hear about. It's not what everybody reacts to of the people that own million-dollar homes on the water and keep rebuilding and get knocked into the ocean. I am fully aware that we shouldn't be rebuilding those houses. I mean, strike two, you're out. The federal government shouldn't be supporting those rebuilds. I guess one of my issues is, and I don't mind the federal fix, although I think there's probably a lot of subsidies then that should be done away with. That's the one that's been supportive of me over the last year. However, you know, there's no in these smaller communities, for instance, Governor Malloy has put out some funding available to people who want to lift their home. Again, my home is worth $175. To lift my home would be about at least $80,000.
Mm.
And the governor has said, we have funding for you to do that at 0%. And I'm not fabulous with numbers, but if I put that together, if I have a $175,000 home and I'm making $60,000 a year, and now I need to take a loan out at 0% for $80,000, the money that Governor Malloy has made available is obviously not for me.
Mm.
It clearly is probably more earmarked for the people who are directly on the ocean who can afford to take out the 0%.
Well, first of all, Jody, thank you for your phone call. And I think you raise an interesting issue. I mean, this is another thing that, you know, New Haven and the surrounding communities have to deal with. When we're up in Hartford, we don't think about some of the flooding issues. But in this community, we've heard about this for years. And this is not, you know, waterfront mansions in Fairfield County here, Paul.
Yeah, they talk about rebuilding the seawall.
Jody, hold on for a second. Yeah, go ahead, Paul.
Sounds like Jody's immediate need is the federal law, right? She wants to help with the insurance. A lot of people look at zero percentage interest loans as sort of grants. You could invest the money elsewhere. I'm probably more like Jody that I wouldn't want to bother having to play the finance high rolling game to make that work. I know they want to rebuild the seawall in Morris Cove. I do think that people maybe who don't live exactly on Jody Street have to think about why they're buying right on the water in an era of climate change.
Yeah, I want to get to a break here, and there's a lot more that we want to tackle. We're talking about the news of the week in the wheelhouse, and we're in New Haven today. We're taking a lot of calls from people in the New Haven area at 860-275-7266. Our guests include Paul Bass, the editor of the New Haven Independent, Mark Oppenheimer, who is a religion columnist for the New York Times, Colin McEnroe, who's host of the Colin McEnroe Show, and James Walker, who's metro editor of the New Haven Register. We'll be right back after this break, where we live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, for the second time in recent months, Senator Chris Murphy traveled with other U.S. senators to Kiev to meet with the new political leaders in the embattled country of Ukraine. Coming up tomorrow, we'll be joined in studio by Senator Chris Murphy to debrief on his trip and discuss the latest developments in that region. You can join us on tomorrow's Where We Live. Today, it's The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable, and we're joined, as always, by Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. He's in our Hartford studios today. Joining me in New Haven is Paul Bass from the New Haven Independent, Mark Oppenheimer, who writes a religion column for the New York Times and is the author of several books, including the e-book Zen Predator of the Upper East Side, and James Walker, who's metro editor of the New Haven Register. We're taking your phone calls at 860-275-7266, and we'll get back to those in just a moment. There's a new law proposes making drug enforcement zones around schools smaller. It's a measure aimed at giving teeth to a law that's been on the books since 1987. According to the Prison Policy Initiative, 94% of Hartford's residents, 93% of New Haven's residents, and a high number of Bridgeport's residents as well, live in areas covered by a sentencing enhancement zone. Now, here's new Senator Gary Holder Winfield last week discussing a proposal to reduce the size of the drug-free school zones.
This bill would reduce the drug zones from 1,500 feet down to approximately 200 feet. The purpose of doing so is to make it possible for in communities such as New Haven, Hartford, and some of our more dense communities, that you can actually have areas where there's a differentiation between what the punishment is for dealing drugs. So in a community like New Haven, there's actually no area where if you deal drugs, you don't have a difference. The problem with that is if we intend to have an area with an enhanced penalty for dealing to young people, and there is no area, then if you deal drugs based upon your knowledge of the law, you would have no reason to stay away from our young people. So doing a bill like this would actually make our young people safer, as counterintuitive as that may seem.
That's Gary Holder Winfield, a new state senator. We can talk a little bit more about him. This is a story, actually, that we've been kind of interested in. We may do a larger Where We Live on. Is this a big issue in New Haven, Paul?
Well, it's interesting. Last night I was at a convention for the people running to replace Gary Holder Winfield in New Haven's and Hamden's 94th General Assembly District. I asked every one of the six people, and now it's five, running, what do you think about the drug-free zones? Every one of them wanted to keep the law the way it is.
Really?
And they live in those communities. I mean, it's a very interesting argument Gary makes, and I think most criminal justice reformers before it for two reasons. One is the racial impact of people who deal in cities might be more likely to be African-American, Latino than the suburbs, and because your whole city gets defined as a drug-free zone, you end up serving longer. And B, Gary makes the argument that you're actually less safe because, as he said in that clip, if you're trying to pass this law so that you get more of a penalty for being near a school, if your whole town's a school, there's no longer a differential. On the other side, people say, give the cops every tool they can to lock dealers away for long enough. Like people I talked to last night, all of them African-Americans, say, I want more time in jail for more dealers, and I don't want to mess with it.
Colin, did you want to jump in on this?
Well, the only thing I would add to that is, first of all, I do think the law should be changed. I mean, you have situations like, you know, E.O. Smith, a school in stores. I think their drug-free zone includes a lot of the UConn campus, where, in fact, people do sell and take drugs. and it just doesn't really make any sense. You know, I think, Gary, it was a complicated thing and a hard thing to explain, but I think he explained it pretty well. You want it to actually have some meaning, and it doesn't have meaning the way it is.
But the truth is, I think most firms would have no drug-free zones, period, that it's a fake Band-Aid put on by a drug war that doesn't work.
I'd agree with that.
Because most of the kids, the schools closed that. When they're dealing. It's like the schools shut down at 11 at night or 1 in the morning when, you know, the playboys on the east side or whatever are dealing their drugs.
James, did you want to jump in?
No, I think Paul made a good point when he said he talked to a lot of African-Americans and we want longer jail sentences. But I think Holder makes he has a very valid argument. I think he does have a very valid argument. It does impact the minority community a heck of a lot. But we get back to, we're talking about drugs, and we're talking about dealing drugs in areas where our youth are, and that's never a good thing. How you combat that, I'm not sure, but it's not a good thing.
We were talking before the show about something that I know that you're interested in talking a little bit more about, and it's the prevalence of the conversation about marijuana in society.
Right.
You know, we have medical marijuana laws here. Of course, it's essentially been decriminalized in Connecticut. Mm-hmm. It's sending an interesting message, I suppose, to all the people who've been arrested on drug charges over the years.
I don't understand the message that it is sending. I don't understand why. Because you put something under the guise of medical, suddenly it is okay. It is still marijuana. I don't care what you call it. I don't care what it's used for. It is marijuana. If some people are going to use it for medicinal purposes, some people are going to use it for pleasure. But I think the war on young minorities who are dealing marijuana and just marijuana, no weapons or anything else, just marijuana, is absurd. It is ridiculous.
And it's about this message, Mark, that's sent to all of these young men who are in prison right now for something that many states, including Connecticut, seem to just be saying it's okay now.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, if you're one of the people sentenced under one of these harsh laws, I mean, although as Paul was pointing out earlier, you know, it's been usage has been decriminalized in a sense, especially a first offense is now misdemeanor, but selling hasn't been, which is this weird disjuncture. And of course, it's still federally illegal, but they're not enforcing it on the state. So it's still this very weird patchwork. I think everyone knows where this is going, which is that 50 years from now, we're going to look back at the current incarceration regime and drug law regime and say that was a waste of time and money. It's a shame that we can't get there sooner, but I think we all know where you'd be very hard-pressed to make a case that that's not the direction we're heading in.
This week, the state of Connecticut put one last person on death row, although the state repealed the death penalty back in 2012. It didn't apply to the case of Richard Roskowski. He was originally sentenced to death in 2009, but the sentence was overturned, and he was resentenced to death this week. He's the final person to be placed on death row, but Colin, I mean, will he ever be put to death? This is a really interesting continuation of this death penalty debate in the state.
Yeah, I mean, bet against him ever being put to death. The history of this, I think it may be almost universal that in states that have eliminated the death penalty, the lame duck people on death row are never executed. And I think it also speaks to an anomaly that came up as we were debating this. Again and again, you heard not only from Governor Malloy, but also from legislators like Edith Prague and Andy Maynard, this kind of tipping of the hat to the Cheshire murders, as if somehow or other they had to stay as part of the death penalty if there was ever going to be any change. And the truth is, there aren't a lot of nicer people on death row. I mean, the kind of people who get convicted for I support the elimination of the death penalty, but I don't do that thinking that mostly it's much nicer people than Hayes and Komisarjevsky. I mean, what this guy did was horrible. What the other people on death row did was horrible. These are horrible people. You just have to decide that you're not going to execute them.
Mark, do you have a thought on this?
I was just thinking back to when my wife used to do capital cases and how – we would talk about the facts of the cases of people, some of whom, not all of whom were guilty, but some of whom were. And I was just, I was having exactly Colin's thought, which was that the reason to eliminate the death penalty isn't that most of the people who get sentenced are innocent, because most of them aren't innocent, although surely some innocent people have been sentenced. And it's not because all of them or most are can be rehabilitated, although surely some can. It's because you don't want the state to be taking lives unnecessarily. So, I was nodding along with Colin.
We have just a few minutes left, and I want to get to a few last things, including something, Colin, I know will make your day. This week, yet another candidate jumped into the governor's race, Lee Whitnum. She previously ran for U.S. Senate, and she had a memorable moment during a debate on NBC.
I'm dealing with whore here who sells his soul to AIPAC, who will say anything for the job.
That was Lee Whitnum.
I can't listen to it without laughing. I mean, I've listened to it like hundreds of times.
I think it's the ringtone on your phone. That's her talking about now U.S. Senator Chris Murphy. Explain a little bit more about who Lee Whitnum is, Colin.
Lee Whitnum's a Democrat, which I think occasionally surprises people. That was part of a U.S. Senate debate. She was talking about Chris Murphy when she said, "I'm dealing with horror here." You can't do it on the radio. You have to see the expressions on the faces in the room of Bisowitz, Oaks, and especially Murphy when she says this. I mean, her views are pretty unpalatable. Although I would just quickly say, the way that she expresses these things is just unconscionable and really hard to listen to. The thing she's trying to bring up is something that gets debated in Europe all the time. It gets debated in Israel all the time. It gets debated everywhere except in America. I mean, it's sort of whether or not our Middle East policy is fully constituted or whether it's kind of artificially narrowed by lobbying interests. But she's the wrong person to try to bring this up because she just is nails across the blackboard in the way that she talks about it. One other quick point. If she were to qualify for the primary, which seems to me to be very unlikely, she triggered the release of $1.3 million in clean election funds to Dan Malloy, which he basically doesn't need.
And I guess one thought, Paul, is couldn't the Democrats just run somebody, just anybody, just
yes.
so they could unlock that $1.3 million?
Yeah. I think Malloy might actually find he needs the money.
he might need the money along the way. Okay, we've got 2 minutes left, and we've got one last topic we want to talk to. Since you brought up Europe, Colin, you know there is a cheese war happening between Connecticut and Europe. Europe essentially wants to copyright the names of their different kinds of cheese. Here's Suzanne Sankow, who's co-owner of Beaverbrook Farm in Lyme, speaking with WNPR yesterday.
What they want to do is the European Trade Union does not want Americans to use European names for their cheeses, such as Brie, Feta, Gouda, Camembert, and they want to control it the same way they control champagne.
The same way they control champagne, and Chris Murphy has gotten in on this. There is a big cheese culture here in New Haven, Mark. There's a great cheese store right around the corner. What do you think about this cheese debate?
that you're referring to Casius, which is a great fromagerie. I think Vladimir Putin is behind it all in ways that we haven't even begun to understand. And it's really about the cheese culture in Crimea.
Has anybody interviewed Ed Munster about this?
That's actually a very good idea. Do you think that European cheeses, by their nature, Paul, are better than cheeses made here in Connecticut?
Well, speaking as a vegan, I really don't care where people get their animal fat.
There's a whole vegan cheese debate.
Vegan cheese is lousy. I'm going to try to
sliced American. That's
sliced American. And they can never take that away from us. Right?
They'll take my Connecticut cheese away when they pry my cold dead fingers off the gorgonzola.
Colin McEnroe is host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. He's got great Irish music coming up this afternoon at 1. Thank you so much, Colin.
Thank you, John.
Thanks also to James Walker, Metro editor of the New Haven Register. Thank you, James.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks to Mark Oppenheimer, who's a religion columnist for the New York Times and the author of several books. Good to see you once again, Mark.
Merci.
And also to Paul Bass, editor of the New Haven Independent. You can always find out what's happening with Paul. Thank you so much, Paul.
Thank you, John. Pleasure to be on. Glad to have you in New Haven.
Oh, always glad to be in New Haven. We are broadcasting here today, and we'll be back regularly here on Where We Live on The Wheelhouse. I want to thank Lori Mack for being our engineer today. Tucker Ives and Lydia Brown produced the show, and the executive producer is Katie Solarski. I'm John Dankowski. This is Where We Live.